Andrew Talks to Chefs is an independent podcast. For current and past episodes, Andrew's blog, contact information, and more, please visit andrewtalkstochefs.com. To support us, please visit patreon.com/andrewtalkstochefs. Enjoy the show.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stone.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
I'm extremely proud of what the restaurant was and what the team together with me created and how much pleasure and how many experiences that created for other people and all of that stuff. And that makes me feel a bit nostalgic. But then when I think about separate dishes, it's like, I don't feel anything, which surprised me because I hadn't thought about that either. I really do think that the day we closed, I just turned that bit off. Maybe one day I wake up in the morning and I just feel super excited about, you know, a dish that I've dreamt of that night and, you know, want to open a restaurant again. But that hasn't happened yet.
That is the voice of Magnus Nelson, author of the new book, Faviken, 4,015 Days, Beginning to End. He is our guest on this episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses to make some sense. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I am delighted today to bring you our second conversation with Chef Magnus Nelson. Magnus will be familiar to many of you listeners out there, whether or not you've been listening to this show for a long time. His restaurant, Faviken, was a landmark restaurant that had a 12-year run in northern Sweden that closed a little under a year ago. It was a decision that Magnus was fortunate to be able to make on his terms, and he has now moved on to some other endeavors, which he talks about in this conversation. But the reason for this conversation is Magnus has just put out a new book. It comes to us from the House of Fiden, and the book is called Faviken, 4,015 Days, Beginning to End. And as that title suggests, the book is basically the story of the restaurant from start to finish, soup to nuts, as they used to say in the restaurant industry in the United States. And it's quite a document. It's a beautiful book, as we would expect from Fiden and from Magnus, with spectacular photography throughout. And it has basically everything you would want to know about this restaurant for posterity. There is a catalog of all the dishes ever served at the restaurant, organized by year. There are recipes that are presented in incredible detail, almost as if they were being explained to a young cook at the restaurant who would need to prepare these things. There's incredible photography, as I mentioned, and there are essays or think pieces scattered throughout the book that examine everything from creativity to sustainability to a bit of a forecast or a crystal ball moment that Magnus allows himself toward the end of the book about what to expect post-pandemic. We get into all of that in the interview. And to be honest, I don't think there's a whole lot more I need to say about it. So with that, I'm going to get you right to it. My conversation with Magnus Nelson. Here you go. Magnus, congratulations on another terrific book.
Thank you.
My first question for you is a fairly basic one, but given, A, the fact that you decided to write a book about a restaurant that no longer exists in the physical world, and B, that this book comes to us during an extreme global circumstance, which you do address toward the end of the book, can you take me through the timeline of the project? When did you decide you wanted to do this, and when did you put the manuscript to bed?
Actually, as far as books go, I decided quite late, if you sort of in relationship to the publication date, to do this book. And at first, I was quite hesitant, you know, because as I write in the introduction, I think, you know, who would write a book about the restaurant that doesn't exist anymore and who's going to want to read it. I think that what made me want to write this book eventually was that I felt that there were so many things said by other people about Fabiken throughout the years, you know, through media, television, blogs, traditional magazines and newspapers and so on, but also through all of the people who'd been to the restaurant as guests in their recollections of their memories to friends and so on. So I kind of felt in the end that I also wanted to like have a final say and describe the story of Fabiken the way I saw it without any filters in between. And writing a book like this is a very good way of doing that. And I also realized during that decision-making process that there is actually so many people out there in the world for whom Fabiken meant something. A source of inspiration or a goal for something to visit or, you know, something else entirely. But there are so many people that it meant something for that I figured that it would be a bit of a wasted opportunity to not write the book.
When you mention other people having their say about the restaurant, what it meant, et cetera, and you wanting to have, you know, your own voice out there commemorating Fabiken, that seems to me to suggest, and I'm not asking you to name names, but that seems to me to suggest that maybe there were things being said or conceptions being perpetrated that you didn't necessarily agree with.
I don't have any specific examples of things that I don't necessarily agree with at all, but I think that that's like always the case. You know, we all have a different perception of something that exists, which is a funny thing because you could argue that something that exists, it's a sort of static expression of something. But people do, like two people experience like, the exact same thing. They don't have the same perception of that experience, and therefore they're not going to have the same story to tell about it either. And I just felt that after 12 years, you know, and so many people coming through the doors of Fabiken and telling others about their experience there in different ways, good or bad, or, you know, that doesn't really matter. But I just felt in the end that I also wanted to have my say.
Well, and you could get very philosophical about this, right? Because the restaurant, in fact, on the cover of the book, you list the number of days.
Yeah.
You know, the restaurant as it experienced in 1 year had to be different from how it was experienced a year or two later. But obviously, anybody who goes to enough restaurants or who has worked in restaurants knows how you experience it on a Wednesday may be different than how you yourself would experience if you came the next night. No,
absolutely.
No two services are identical.
Yeah, exactly like that, you know. And even during one single service, two people sitting next to each other, they are not going to have the exact same experience either, you know, because even if we would serve them the exact same thing and the room would be the same room and all of those things, those two people, they're going to be in a different mindset and have a different set of experiences with them to relate to the experience they're currently sharing, which means that you know, their recollection of it is not going to be the same either.
When you sat down to write this book, did you have a particular audience in mind? I ask because, first of all, it joins this, it's a small group, but, you know, you're not the first person to do a book about a restaurant not long after it closed. Wiley Dufresne, obviously, just did that very recently. But, you know, as someone who's done some historical research myself in the realm of restaurants, you know, I was looking at this and especially even just the catalog of dishes, I was imagining what that might look like to a scholar of hospitality or a scholar of food, you know, 50, 60 years from now. It seems to me like for that person in their audience, this is an invaluable document.
Yeah, actually a very cool thought. I haven't thought about that at all, actually. But I agree. I mean, as a person who's also done research on food culture in my two previous books, Nordic Cookbook and Nordic Baking Book, I can definitely relate to that. And I mean, if I were to do a book 50 years from now, documenting sort of the rise of new Nordic cuisine, then obviously a document like this would be very, very valuable.
Yeah, because usually when you do that kind of work, you're often at the mercy of you know, what menus might survive in various people's, you know, file drawers, or what dishes got mentioned in reviews. It's very unusual to have something this comprehensive about a single restaurant.
Yeah. No, so for me, when I wrote the book, though, I mean, I didn't have a particular reader in mind. That said, I do know that, I mean, there is a large part of the people that buy my books are people from the hospitality industry, of course. And then the other large part would be like private individuals that would have a special interest in food. So, I mean, of course, even if that was not part of like the structural process of planning the book, that's needless to say on the back of your mind when you're writing.
I was reading through the book. There was quite a bit of detail for some dishes that you describe. I'm going to throw something out there, and I would just love to you to honestly respond. If I'm completely off the mark, please tell me. But, you know, it seems to me that one of the things that's true of any restaurant, but it's even more true in a number of respects for a restaurant like Five Again, is that it is part of a continuum, right? The culinary craft is one that is very much passed down in 2020 as it was 100 years ago or 200 years ago. It's passed down usually by learning in person, on the job, in a restaurant. And now, I mean, you may decide, as you say in the book, to do another restaurant if you catch fire again at some point. But, you know, for the time being, you are not teaching young cooks in Five Again. You the people who work for you are not teaching the people who are part of their station. And it feels to me like this part of this book was an effort to sort of capture between two covers the sort of information, the kind of instruction, the kind of loving detail that maybe a young cook would be privy to had they come to work for you, which they can no longer do. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, once again, that wasn't part of my plan, but I think it's definitely like a correct analysis. I mean, I remember my beginnings as a cook after culinary school, being, you know, 18, 19 years old, and reading all of these books that came out then, which would have been like the French Laundry cookbook. It would have been Michel Brass book. It would have been a series of books from Charlie Trotter, and a few others like that, you know. And I mean, those were restaurants then that I'd never visited. I'd never met the chefs running them. I had no relationship to them except that I knew that they were really, really good. And the information in those books, it just sort of made me feel as if I had been a part of, you know, those restaurants somehow, which was important back then to me.
I totally get what you're saying, and I can see how that would, you know, there's almost a dotted line from that to this book. It's funny that this whole book hangs together because it is so disparate in terms of what's in it, right? There's a catalog of dishes. There's, you know, a number of recipes of we can say dramatically varying length, right? Some of them are a portion of a page and some of them are several pages long. And then there are essays or think pieces. And you're very frank in some of the things you write in the book. You're very polite, but you're very frank. You know, there's an essay about sustainability where you basically point out that, in your opinion, a lot of the way some restaurants and chefs talk about it is it's not really accurate. It's something that's actually very difficult to achieve in a real way. It's sort of a buzzword that people feel they need to throw around. You also talk about your own ego and how, you know, you're someone who strikes me as given what you've achieved, remarkably modest, but you do talk about, you know, what it's like to suddenly be deprived of all this adulation that you were privy to for, you know, more than a decade running this restaurant. Was that part of the original plan? And are those thoughts that you feel more comfortable sharing now when you're not speaking for a functioning restaurant the way you were when Favican was extant? Are you more comfortable saying these things now when you're sort of between restaurants or maybe out of that game for a while?
Yeah, I think that's a double yes on that one. I mean, it was definitely part of the plan of writing this book to address a few of those things that I feel very strongly about and that I've spent a lot of time thinking about during these last 10 years. And yes, definitely I feel more at ease talking about them now when I'm not part of the game, which it is to run a restaurant like Favican. I mean, especially addressing the like that sustainability chapter, for example, I think that it is like, you know, incredibly detrimental if we're going to try as, you know, people living on planet Earth to make our existence here more sustainable, to call things that aren't sustainable, you know, sustainable. And that's what's happening in so many top restaurants today, including Favican. I mean, I can't even begin counting how many sustainability awards I was offered during the years at Favican and never accepted because, I mean, deep inside, I knew that it wasn't, you know, like Favican wasn't a sustainable business in any way. It was an incredibly resource-intensive restaurant. And quite frankly, even though I know that we made a lot of people very happy, we created experiences and we created a lot of value. Like if you just look at the meal as such, I mean, completely unnecessary, really, from like the basis of of what a meal can be. And I think that it's like, you know, I don't think that it's good to say that something that's not sustainable is sustainable because it detracts attention from other things that are truly sustainable. And if we're going to be able to make any real difference in the world when it comes to this, I think that we have to start realizing that not everything that we do as human beings can or should be equally sustainable. Because then everything will just become a gray mass of, you know, nothing. And people are not going to put up with that, which means that they're not going to do it then. So I think that it's really important that we start looking at sustainability as a bit like we do with money, you know. You have a finite amount per year, for example, that you can spend. And if you choose to spend you know, your sustainability currency, for example, on going to a restaurant like Favican, which is very resource intensive, that's fine. But then you have to save up somewhere else. Then you can't spend, you know, on other things that also cost a lot of sustainability currency. And if we never call things for what they are, like that type of approach can never really work.
And what also, when you say, I mean, I think I could say this now, I don't think you would have even been offended by it when the restaurant was still functioning. But, you know, when you say from a, you know, that this meal is completely unnecessary, I mean, you could also talk about the cart. You do mention in that essay you write that I think it's dated May of this year about the pandemic, you know, that for a number of people who came to Favican, there was, a flight involved, you know, so the, you know, the carbon footprint of meals that exist on the level of a restaurant like Favican that people might travel a decent portion around the globe to experience is that's not insignificant in that discussion.
No, it isn't. And I think that's like the way I see it, it's fine. And we should do things that make us, you know, that will make us very happy and that creates experiences. But we have to do it with moderation and we have to do it as conscious choices. And we can't do it based on, you know, someone claiming that they are something they're not in the same way as we can't base purchases on, you know, in relationship to our money based on information that isn't accurate. And I think that this is like, to me, this is also not, which is important to say, it's not like a way to avoid taking responsibility for restaurateurs to reason this way. It's not at all, because we all have to be more mindful than, you know, we've been in the past. We all have to be better at managing our resources and making sure that we don't spend more than we need to do what it is that we want to do. But that's more, you know, I prefer to use other words than sustainability when I talk about these things. I think that, you know, responsibility is actually a much better word.
Yeah, I would agree. And I, actually, if I can find it, I'll send it along to. But years ago, I read a great article about, you know, that sustainability was one of these terms that, you know, it's used a lot. But if you ask any 10 non-experts about it, you're very likely to get 10 different definitions. And they probably are all definitions that sort of, you know, tend to flatter whoever it is that's offering it, you know?
Yeah. No, and that's the thing, you know, because it is actually very, very easy. Like, something that's sustainable is something that can go on indefinitely without having a detrimental impact on its surrounding. That's like, it's a very simple definition. And if you also impose that definition on most modern fine dining restaurants or experiential restaurants, you also realize that that's not really the truth, right?
So I'd love to talk to you for just a moment about this essay you wrote that's in the back of the book, because, you know, it's dated 12th May 2020. That was, I guess, about 2 months. Well, it depends where you were. Here in the U.S., that would have been about 2 months into our lockdown. It would have been longer in various locations in Europe. But it's a real meditation on how this moment, this extended moment that unfortunately is still coming and going in waves, affects your industry or your trade in particular. I'm wondering where you are in your thinking right now, because in a lot of ways that essay was actually, although I think it was very clear-eyed and very honest, it struck me as fairly optimistic in a lot of ways.
No, I'm still pretty optimistic. I mean, the thing is that I'm at the same time also very realistic. And I can acknowledge that, like, now we're here early November, and most likely we are, like, not even, you know, in the real beginning of the worst part of this, like, realistically. This winter is probably going to be less good than last winter. And that's obviously not very encouraging. But I also do think that we have to, like, in difficult times like this, remember, like, how the world functions and what drives people. And if you look at restaurants specifically, I mean, there is no doubt that there is going to be plenty of restaurants, like, that have, you know, that are closing now that are never going to open up again, undeservedly, you know, restaurants that under normal circumstances would have thrived. That's very, very sad, of course. But I also don't believe in this sort of idea that is sometimes being put forward currently, that restaurants are going away and never going to come back because of this.
Right, that it's some kind of a restaurant ice age.
Yeah, I don't believe in that. Because, I mean, the fact is that when we're through this, because this is a temporary thing, even if it's a long, you know, temporary thing, the world is going to come back again to some kind of normal operations. And when we come back again, when we don't have to worry about this in the same way as we do now, you know, there's going to be places that are empty that used to house restaurants that are very well suited to housing restaurants again. There's going to be people that are good at running restaurants that currently have no restaurants. There are going to be people that used to work in restaurants that are currently unemployed, and they're going to want to work in restaurants again because that's what they are good at and that's what they're passionate about. And there's also going to be, and this is most importantly, customers. So the reason why people aren't going to restaurant right now is not because they don't want to. It's because they can't, right? And I don't believe for a second that people are not going to want to go to restaurants again when all of this is over. So you have all of the things needed for restaurants to exist, really. The sad truth, of course, is that there is going to be plenty of places that undeservedly are going to have to close and never reopen again. But that's also, if you try to see this in a more optimistic way, potentially an opening for new places that would otherwise not have been given the chance to open, to come into life. And for me, I mean, I already knew when I closed Fabriken what a huge privilege it was to get to choose the moment when you close your restaurant. Because most people, pandemic or not, they don't get to choose. They have to close the restaurant for some reason, some external reason that's out of their control, right? That privilege has become even more apparent during this year. And I mean, during spring, I even felt a little bit of guilt about this when I saw like how many people that like really struggled now. And I kind of just closed this place that were functioning super well, you know. But then I thought to myself that that doesn't really help anyone, you know. So I decided that I'm going to just be very happy that I got to enjoy that privilege. And, do what I can to make sure that as many people are as well equipped as possible to reopen again. And, you know, that's something that I can really influence through my sort of new job as well in Copenhagen with Mad Academy.
Can you explain to people what it is that you're doing there?
Yeah, so Mad Academy, it's sort of the new project of Mad Foundation. The Mad Foundation was started by René Redzepi of NOMA now 11 years ago. With like the overarching goal to essentially make the world better through hospitality. And it's an organization that has done a lot of different things throughout the years, perhaps most well known for its biannual MAD Symposium in Copenhagen. And since about 1 year now, we've been working on a project that's called MAD Academy, which is a school for people working in hospitality and food. And it's not a school where we're going to teach anyone to cook better or to know more about wine or, you know, anything like that. It's a school where we want to equip people that are already like good craftspeople and actively working in hospitality. We want to equip them with tools and knowledge and inspiration so that they'll make better choices and create positive change. And essentially, we have two programs, one that's on environment and sustainability and one that's on leadership and business. And the whole reason why I said yes to this is that, I mean, I've seen firsthand through the years, both where I worked before and also through my own actions at Fabriken, how poorly prepared most people that open restaurants are for like the realities of what it means to run a business responsibly, whether it's on the environmental side or whether it's on the leadership and business side. And, you know, I think that we can really make a difference if we just equip people a little bit better from the beginning.
Yeah, it is so funny that it's something that struck me for years. I know it is getting better at cooking schools and culinary academies, but for the longest time, there was not even a fundamental course in most of these schools on how to properly manage a team. I mean, there was plenty of technical instruction, but very little about sort of the big picture, you know, how to marshal the troops toward a common goal. That was something either if you were naturally equipped for that, or if you happened to work for someone who was a good model for that, maybe you got lucky. But a lot of people, you know, they spent their whole lives in this profession, never really managing people in a good or effective way.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing, you know. And that's sort of what I came to realize at Fabriken, because, I mean, I started Fabriken when I was 24 years old. So I was young immature. I didn't have any of the tools that you would need to start a business like that in terms of neither like leadership nor business management. And I had worked in very, very high performing places before, but also places that did lack in effective and, you know, kind leadership, for example. I made so many mistakes that it took me, I've been sort of looking back through the years there and through my notes and like really thinking about like this process. And I think it took me about 6 years of like trial and error and making so many mistakes, inflicting a lot of pain on other people and on myself as well from those mistakes before I actually came to the point where I became pretty good at leading my team. And I think that that's just plain wrong, you know. It's silly. And it's one of the main reasons why hospitality is such a dysfunctional business or line of business. And I feel like a lot of the things that took me so long to like get a hang of, it's stuff that, you know, you can teach it very easily. It's like really basic things, you know, and it's things that a lot of other industries have functions already implemented for. So that when you become a manager, when you, you know, become a person who's responsible for other human beings, you're already equipped for it. Like regardless if you have an aptitude or not, you've been given the, you know, the tools and the knowledge to work in a better way. And that's really what I'm sort of hoping that we can do.
Stylistic question for you. I, never having been to your restaurant, but having, you know, seen your books and now having spent a lot of time with this document of what you did there, I see a bit of a similarity between what you all did in the kitchen there, what you offered to guests of the restaurant, and your writing style. Your writing style to me seems very, it's, and I mean this as a compliment, it's very straightforward, and it's very confident in the integrity of the ideas. It doesn't feel to me terribly dressed up with a lot of flowery language. It's very matter of fact, and you sort of just let the anecdotes, the detail, the ideas really stand on their own. You don't try to kind of dress them up to try to make them seem like more than what they are. And I think that seems to me very much in line with the way you cook. Is that an accurate comparison?
Yeah, I haven't thought about it that way, but yeah, I think it is. It's definitely true about the cooking. And I mean, with the writing, I think that it's like, it's you know, I just want to explain my thoughts. That's all it is. And I kind of come to realize through the years after having, you know, written quite a lot, actually, at least for being a cook, you know, writing not being my primary occupation, I kind of come to realize that most of the time, like, it's just easier to explain what it is that you mean if you keep it sort of simple in terms of language. And it's like there is this letter that I often think about. It's kind of funny. Maybe you've seen it because you can see it online. It was written to in response to a letter or an essay that some young journalist sent into Roald Dahl, the writer. And it's Roald Dahl's response. And it's not a very lengthy thing, but he gives some direct feedback. And he's like, it's a very funny letter because you can feel that he's a bit irritated about even, you know, having to reply, but he still does it. And he uses, you know, he really explains this thing about like keeping it tight. And he uses the phrase beastly adjectives, which I think is just fantastic about, you know, it expresses everything about, to me, about what you shouldn't include in your writing, I think.
Well, it also, to me, you know, it's funny. I still remember, I didn't even have to look it up, but, you know, you and I interviewed when you did your baking book, and I remember saying that I was really struck that every once in a while, mm-hmm. you kind of slip in a word that jumps out in the context of that style. And I remember at the time, you refers to a kick-ass strawberry jam. And I remember that kick-ass, you know, jumped out. And you do once in a while in here, you will, I forget what it was, but you do reference, you know, that something seems like shit at one point. There's a place where you compare a kohlrabi dish that you had, I think it was in Japan, to great sex. You know, these little moments when it is as plain spoken as most of your prose is, these little flourishes or these little very well-selected moments where you deviate just slightly, they really make a big impact. And again, but I do think of that in the way I think about, you know, an ingredient jumping out in a dish. I mean, it does feel like that to me.
Yeah, I think you can definitely look at it in the same way. And I mean, for me, like one thing that has been so important throughout like these books that I've written, since I also write them myself and I take great pleasure in the actual writing exercise, it's been super important for me to find a way to preserve my own voice. And my voice is that of a person who has studied a lot of English, read a lot of English, but is not a native English speaker. And that's been, you know, something to really, like, it's been a challenge with, you know, working with a publisher, British-based publisher owned by an American family, and with an entirely English-speaking kind of background. But they've been very cool about this. And they've been, you know, really, supportive of this idea that, you know, we're not going to edit these books to the point where it looks like a book on English grammar. We're going to keep, like, those little oddities and those little kind of quirky Swedishisms that are in there. As long as people understand what the meaning of the texts are, that's fine. And for this last book, which was, to me, it was very important to get that into like a coherent storyline, because it's so easy when you sit there and write about like your own thoughts about your own project, just be rambling about, you know, and assuming lots of knowledge and creating stuff that people can't possibly read and appreciate. And I worked with an editor named Nathan Thornburg on that to kind of really help me to get it concise and to get like the storyline to hold up, but still at the same time preserve those sort of little language things that make up my voice.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it very distinctly you. You know, I think about, you know, there's a writer in Los Angeles, Gustavo Arellano, who, you know, he refers to it as Spanglish, but you know, he does weave in occasionally a Spanish word into an otherwise English sentence, and it makes it his own. And I think there's a very distinct voice that comes through loud and clear in this book. Can you tell me, you describe in the book, and this might be my last question actually, but you describe these series of mornings where you woke up and, you know, you describe being conscious, but not really having the motivation to want to get out of bed and go to work. And this was the beginning of your decision to close Favikin. And I'm just curious, now that you're on the other side of that decision for a while, now that this book is complete, do you still have, you know, ideas for a, have you been able to totally shut off that part of your brain, I guess is what I'm wondering. Like, do ideas for dishes that would have been right at home in that setting still come to you? Do you document these in whatever way you used to do that? Is there still an active notebook or computer file where these sort of ideas with no home now or maybe forever are archived? What's sort of the state of your, well, to use a word that you use in the book that you write about, what's sort of the state of your own creative life on that front right now?
Well, you know, it's actually pretty weird because I haven't thought about that one bit since we closed. Like, nothing.
And really? You mean instantaneously, yeah, that was shut off?
Yeah, it was. And this is actually the first time I think about it since then, which is really weird.
But I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Not at all. I think that was a great question. I was asked a couple of weeks ago by someone like to name like a dish that meant something, like that was really special to me, like one of the more memorable dishes from Favikin or something like that. I don't remember exactly the question. And I was thinking, and then I realized that I felt nothing for them. You know, I'm extremely proud of like what the restaurant was and like what the team together with me created and how much pleasure and how many experiences that, you know, created for other people and all of that stuff. And that makes me feel a bit nostalgic. But then when I think about separate dishes, it's like, I don't feel anything, which is, you know, it surprised me because I hadn't thought about that either. And I really do think that, like, the day we closed, I just turned that bit off. And I, you know, I haven't looked back. And maybe one day I wake up in the morning and I just feel super excited about, you know, a dish that I've dreamt of that night and, you know, want to open a restaurant again. But that hasn't happened yet. And that's also the reason, I guess, why I haven't already like moved on and started planning something new, you know?
Is that, I mean, it sounds like that was surprising to you that I guess that avenue of thought, which, you know, most of us don't think of us as having control over that, right? Like you said, you're not even dreaming new dishes. I mean, we have no control over what we dream. I would imagine that would give you tremendous validation that you made the right decision for yourself. But I would also imagine that would be a little, I don't know, curious or maybe even a little unnerving.
Yeah, it's very curious. And I was really surprised when I realized that thing a couple of weeks ago that, like, when I thought about the dishes, like, I just couldn't pick one that meant anything more than any other dish because none of them meant anything anymore. I can't explain why, and it's definitely not a conscious decision. It's just the way it happened. And yeah, it is curious, but yeah, I mean, it feels good though.
And that's our show for today. Again, my great thanks to Magnus Nilsson for joining us. If you'd like to learn more about the book, there is a link to where you can find that online via the episode page for today's conversation at andrewtalkstochefs.com. As always, our thanks to After School Special for the music you hear on the show. Please do check out their album Double Barrel, Single Entendre on iTunes. Please do follow us on Instagram. The handle there is @chefpodcast. And if you would rate or review us on Apple Podcasts, it does help more people find the show, and we would really appreciate it. Thank you very much for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs.